Education for March 9th, 2015. Okay, we're going to have a little change in the agenda. The first thing we're going to do is we're going to have a work session on House Bill 2479, since Representative Johnson's here, if anyone has questions. Then we'll have the public hearing on 3069, and then an informational hearing on early learning hubs. Okay. So with that, I open up a work session on House Bill 2479.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2479 requires the trustees of the state library to provide annual grants for public library services for youth, with an emphasis on underserved youth. The fiscal analysis for the bill came back as indeterminate, and so the legislative fiscal has asked that the bill go to Ways and Means.
Okay. Representative Springer.
Chair Doherty, I move House Bill 2479 to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Okay, Representative Springer moves House Bill 2479 to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that it be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Is there any discussion? Okay, seeing none, could the clerk call the roll, please?
Representative McLean? Aye. Representative Caluso? Aye. Representative Reardon? Aye. Representative Wilson? Aye. Vice Chair Frederick? Aye. Vice Chair Springer? Aye. Chair Doherty? Aye.
Thank you. Okay, the motion passes, and the bill will be sent to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. With that, I close the work session on House Bill 2479 and open up a public hearing on House Bill 3069. Representative Johnson, if you could tell us what it is, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3069 requires teacher education institutions and teacher education programs to provide applicants with training related to teaching and testing reading as a condition of being approved. It takes effect July 1st, 2016.
Thank you. Okay, Representative Johnson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Good to see you all again. For the record, I'm Mark Johnson. I live in Hood River, and I'm privileged to represent beautiful House District 52. It's sunny today, just as it is here. But I want to talk to you today a little bit about third grade reading and elementary literacy. That's what this bill has to do with. And as you guys know, I'm sure this is a pretty engaging topic. You'll hear more, I think, testimony from Director or Superintendent Saxon after I'm done here. But throughout the interim period before we got into session, I was very, very involved working with both ODE, the OEIB, the governor's office as well, relating to the topic of third grade literacy. And there are a number of initiatives and proposals that we have in front of us this session to deal with that. And the issue, obviously, is that if we are really going to be serious about reaching our 40-40-20 goals, we need to do some things that will help to move that agenda along and to provide students with the skills that they need to be successful students. And I think it's pretty well established that third grade literacy is perhaps the key benchmark for students. Because we know very well, and I'm sure you've heard this before, that students who read well in third grade or at a benchmark level by the time they leave third grade are at least four times more likely to graduate from high school. Throughout the balance of their academic life in the K-12 system, they will need many fewer interventions, which can be costly and time-consuming. And in general, they are just much more likely to be a successful student. So for that reason, I think it's widely understood and accepted that third grade reading is perhaps the best investment that this state can make at this point in time. So I bring you then to Senate Bill 214, which is the Department of Education's bill that would actually put into place a substantive third grade reading initiative. And it's not just a bill that calls for all-day kindergarten, which it does, but it also calls for the implementation of some very specific academic practices to be put into place that will enable kids to read. And I just want to read through a few of these, because these are what you're going to be hearing more of. I think this bill's on the Senate side now, but it hasn't gotten over here. But in the eyes of those who know how to do this, and in the eyes of those who have had a chance to actually put in place measures that help students read, and if these things are done, we know that the kids will respond and it will be successful. I'll read you through a few of these. It talks about implementation of an evidence-based reading program that's aligned to academic standards and that is tailored to the specific needs of the students served in the school district. Goes on to say, if we also do then implementation of evidence-based interventions, a process to engage families and community-based organizations, if we use data-driven instruction, if we put in place the use of instructional coaches or literacy coaches, if we make sure that there's professional development and a plan for the staff, if we have these measures in place at the elementary classroom level, we know that these things work because they've all been tried in smaller settings, and what the objective is to be able to implement this across the state. Having said that, I think we all would probably agree that within the classroom setting, there's no more important component than the teacher. The teacher is the key to engage the student, to motivate the student, to assess the student, to provide interventions and to design those assessments or those interventions so that the student can be reached where he or she is, and so that they can make the kind of academic progress you're looking for. That relationship is vital. So it follows then that to the degree that this teacher is able to help his or her student become a successful reader is directly related to the teacher's ability to provide quality instruction to that student. Therein, we bring you House Bill 3069. The idea behind House Bill 3069 came to me from an email that I received from the Education Commission of the States probably about the same time we were convening here to start our session. But there's a growing trend across the state from nationally for states to put in place very specific measures to ensure that new teachers that are entering the teaching profession, that are wanting to engage or enter elementary education specifically, have some very specific skills related to assessing a student's literacy needs, being able to devise a program and to put in place measures to help that student read. And the handout that you received, I hopefully you all have it here in front of you, just details what a few states are doing here. For instance, you have Massachusetts. They've put in place their own Massachusetts test for educator licensures. They've designed their own test. And then after a process of starting in the early 2000, they've revised and strengthened the teacher requirements. The MTEL, as they call it, is now being used in three other states, and it's one of the things that they do. Ohio now has a third grade reading guarantee that ensures that every struggling reader gets the support they need. Schools administer reading improvement plans for aiding students beginning and when they start to fall behind. All pre-K through ninth grade teachers are required to pass an assessment of reading instruction beginning in 2017. And their state board is adopting rules to go along with that. It goes on to say then that Wisconsin has a similar measure that they're working on. But what I want you to focus on is the last little blurb here on this page here, which was, again, Oregon. We were evaluated by the National Council on Teacher Quality recently. And in addition to all of our other lofty national rankings, they gave us a D-plus for teacher preparation. Pretty sobering statistics, and we wonder why we are where we're at and why some of our students are not excelling at the way that they could and they should. But what they point out in here is that currently in Oregon, elementary teacher education candidates are required to take two basic subtests. One of these does cover some literacy instruction, but not in the detail outlined by these other states. So my point is, and what House Bill 3069 is getting at, is trying to raise the bar higher for those incoming new elementary teacher candidates to ensure that they can demonstrate proficiency in reading instruction so that when they get into a classroom setting, they have the skills that they need to be able to diagnose, assess, and then develop a reading plan to help these students reach their academic goals. One of the issues we have, one of the problems that we have in Oregon that we face in situations like this and other policy areas too, is that right now our measures are not aligned with ODE literacy objectives. We have the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission that's out here that does the licensure and credentialing and so forth. but they don't necessarily design their plans and their licensure requirements based on what the Department of Ed is trying to push forward regarding policy objectives. We run into this sometime with CTE credentialing and so forth, and I know Representative Reardon knows what I'm talking about there. But again, I see a disconnect here on this issue as well. We've got the department's doing some really tremendous work on thinking about how we can raise the bar and what we need to do to align our efforts so that from the policy level to the implementation level at the classroom, there's alignment in what we're trying to do, and we're all in one accord of what the value of that is. But I would just have you just look on down there to the last two recommendations under the NCTO. The second bullet point is incorporate literacy skills as an integral part in every subject. So in other words, we're going to incorporate literacy in teaching virtually everything we do. But the third one is, I think, the most powerful one, where it says Oregon should articulate specific requirements ensuring that elementary teachers are prepared to intervene and then support students who are struggling. That is a key component, and it's one I think that is lacking, not for lack of attention or lack of effort, but I think we just haven't ever fully made a really concerted effort to make sure this happens. So what I'm calling for, and what I would hope would happen eventually at the passage of this bill and when we have this thing, it will become implemented, is that we would have, in addition to the regular curriculum that teachers, again, in these teacher prep programs, and we have a number of institutions across the state that offer these, is that in that curriculum, a candidate would have to demonstrate proficiency in evaluating and assessing and working with kids. What I'm calling for is not just another bubble test, fill in the bubble test and objective evaluation like that, but actually have to sit down in a classroom setting, show your skills, show your ability to relate to a student, and then design a curriculum and design interventions that will fit the needs of that student. I'm excited about the possibility. I will tell you that what you have in front of you is the first effort. We're working with the institutions, with the stakeholders and so forth, how they could amend their curriculums that they currently have for their new teacher licensures to incorporate an element of reading proficiency within that they currently don't have. I would make mention that currently we do offer a reading endorsement that a teacher can go to if they want to go the extra mile to get that. That's one way, but it's also a very costly way. It can cost an extra $10,000 or $12,000 for a teacher or someone to go back and get their reading endorsement, and then they become a reading specialist. I don't think we need to go to that degree. I'm confident we can redesign some of our curriculums at the institutions that could accomplish this. But the objective here that we're working toward is, where wouldn't it be great if every elementary teacher could truly be a reading specialist in a classroom, that every student could be well served by a teacher that had the skills to engage with that student where they're at, evaluate their skills, make sure that we can provide the interventions, the support, and the encouragement so that every student then can reach that benchmark of being able to read well when they leave third grade. So that's where we're at. I'll leave it there and be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Okay. Any questions? Representative Hack, Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So if you're looking at new hires, mm-hmm. what are your thought processes on those that are already in the classroom working? Because we need to have the same quality in the classroom now, not just those
Agreed.
Who are entering.
Sometimes incrementalism is a much better way to go, as you well know. I wouldn't want to prescribe or demand or require others to go back and get this, but I do think if we can set in place some mechanisms, it could be possible then for districts to be able to offer supports for hopefully the teachers to go back and get this additional credentialing, if you will, or just practicums in doing this. I would say that we are, I think, through implementation of Common Core. I know some of the curriculums, reading adoptions that districts have done, i.e. in my district in Hood River County, we did a brand new reading adoption last year that has some really specific data-driven instructions built into that curriculum. So districts are all over the board, I think, in terms of where they're at with this, but I think it's going to become more of a something that's going to be taken for granted, I think, probably a few years down the road, because it's that important. I think we all agree that reading is the key to, you know, to making a student to be, enabling a student to be successful. And third grade is that time where they go from learning to read to reading to learn.
Mm-hmm. Just one follow-up. Mm-hmm. Agreed completely with that. Huge supporter. This may be a good fit then with those that are involved in the collaboration grants and the class grants.
Could
with
be.
The compensation packages and the incentives that they're putting together with that. So this may very well be a great fit for those folks. So, thank
agreed.
You.
Thank you, Representative.
Okay, thank you. Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple things. One is I'm hoping that you're including teachers in the discussion about how you do this, and teachers' associations and teachers, people who are in the classroom right now in that. You didn't mention that, so I'm just hoping that's the case.
We've had discussions with the professors and so forth, and we're working into, you know, having those discussions with actual classroom instructors as well. We have had the discussion.
Okay. I would ask...
Yes.
I would ask that you not just start with the professors, having taken those classes myself. I understand. But I would talk with folks who are actually working with second and third graders, as well as others who are involved in that, because teachers have been talking about this for centuries. I mean, decades, certainly, that I know of. Secondly, the time that's spent on this in the curriculum for training, for having teacher training, there's only a certain amount of time, and so it's just going to be taken away from something else. I mean, this is you're putting another set of proposals forward. They're good proposals. I mean, I'm not objecting to that, but it's going to take away from something else because of just the way that you have a certain number of classes you can take as a teacher. Within the program, how are you handling that kind of a balance?
Again, Representative Frederick, that's where we're seeking the input from the actual folks at the institutional level to see what they could do to redesign that. So, like I said, certain states are making this progress, so I think there's best practices we can probably employ as we do this. And I would just add, Representative, remember when we took the tour of OHSU together a month ago or so, and we got the chance to tour the new life science building down there at the South Waterfront, which is incredible.
Incredible.
But
absolutely.
The thing that I saw there that I would love to be able to, or I would hope that we could replicate within Oregon and within this program is, you remember how within the doctor's program there, they have basically, they can replicate any sort of setting that a...
Oh, yes, the simulation center.
Simulation center where every person who's on an MD track can be evaluated in their skill set in reacting to any sort of, whether it's an OR type setting or a home health visit type setting or whatever. And then they're peer reviewed. You know, the peers are given input on how they react, how they do, the feedback on that was a good intervention or you missed this one and so forth. That's what I have in my mind's eye, to have a situation where a new teacher could be evaluated by his or her peers as well as her instructors. Good positive feedback. You did this really well. You can improve here. And therefore, when they get out into those actual settings in the classrooms and the schools and so forth, they have a whole different skill set than I think they currently do right now.
Well, thank you. I agree with you that the question I have is regarding capacity, whether we have the number of teachers and professors to be able to do that, and a space. I mean, remember that simulation unit was pretty expensive to do and to set up. And finally, I would ask that, I say this all the time, I would ask that the issue not be the scores on a reading test, but the love of reading. Because what I have run into on a regular basis now is kids who don't want to read because they think that the only reason that they're supposed to be reading is to do a test. They don't see it as something that is enjoyable or something that they're learning from. And I really worry about that. It disturbs me a great deal to see that taking place. So as we look at this, please include joy of reading, not just scores of reading, as we look at this particular issue. Thank you.
Well, yeah, this Representative Fredericks wouldn't be dealing with the assessment at the classroom level. This is just simply equipping the instructor to be able to provide the means necessary. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Springer.
And thank you, Madam Chair. So in looking at the bill, this would be done by TSPC.
TSPC will design the new standards, correct.
And
So they certainly would be the agency that would be in charge of this. This is a great idea, and I like it. It's good enough that I'd want to make sure it's done in a way that it will be impactful and effective. And as I sit on Ways and Means, and as we look at TSPC, without going too deep into the numbers here, there's already some issues about the workload and what is getting done, and key performance measures at maybe 50%, sometimes less. So I'm thinking, how can we add in that environment, how can we add something to this level, which is kind of a new thing? We think of licensing. Licensing at TSPC is a lot about marking off the boxes. That's very important, but that's not a quality assessment that's being done. And now we're looking along those lines, and so I'm wondering if that is an agency that is equipped to do that.
In other words, make up the rules.
Make up the rules and then implement them when we have some complaints, average length of a complaint. Now, that can be terrible stuff and little stuff, whole gambit. The average is 12 months. The goal is to complete a licensure application in 20 days. Let's just say that's still a goal in process. Mm-hmm. So now we're adding a pretty big piece to that.
Okay. Representative Springer, I think you share some of my same sentiments, and we actually have another piece of legislation that we work towards alleviating that circumstance as well. So I'll just leave it at that and say I hear what you're saying, and I think there's means to correct that and provide better alignment between the policy and the actual credentialing or licensure.
Thank you. Okay. Representative McLean, then Representative Rudin.
Well, first of all, I think probably I'm hearing from the committee that they see the goal and they really appreciate the goal of your legislation. And as you pointed out, right now we're kind of in an endorsement process to get to some of these same issues. I have a daughter-in-law who is a second grade reading coach, and she's a reading coach for an elementary school where she has the responsibility of going into those classes and helping the teacher learn how to teach those reading courses better, assess those kids better, and then provide with lessons that would hopefully get better results. And she does that for, you know, her entire elementary school. And I just wanted to acknowledge that, because I think that Representative Hack had a good issue, and that is getting all these people back out into a classroom or a summer program, or having, as you pointed out, an expensive class to take.
Yeah, it is.
Might not be able to do the whole goal lifting, right? And so I just wanted to acknowledge that maybe looking at this and maybe some tweaks to this one and some thinking about, you know, how long it would take to put something like this into place and do it right, that we could still be encouraging, you know, the model of work on teaching with the specialists that you have in your buildings. So I don't know. It's not really a question. It's just sort of a comment to think about as I'm thinking about your legislation.
Yeah, Representative McLean, I appreciate that. I think you're here and you and I are on the same page. Love to offer this sort of support to every teacher should they have need for it and interest in it. But again, I think, as I said, nationally, I think there's a concerted push to try to help every elementary classroom teacher be as close to one of these reading coaches or reading specialists as possible, because they're in lies so much of the problem.
Right.
But if we can interact with every student individually and provide that kind of differentiated instruction that they need, then we can really make some things happen.
Okay, thank you. Representative Rudin?
I think this is, follow on to that, I think this is sort of like a pilot, really, for how could we do instruction. So I really support the direction you're going. Just one comment. Is as we do this and we teach the teachers, we need to make sure that it's set up in a way that reflects reality. And the current reality is that sometimes as teachers are facing 30, 32 little eager learners in a class, and
that's
the best
class.
Instruction might take place with 4 to 6 kids. So we just need to keep that reality in mind, and I'm starting to design a curriculum now, but so forgive me, but please, as they roll this out, keep that in mind that we just don't have the class sizes we want, and need to deal with that.
That's one reason why we need to get that K-12 number to 8 billion, right?
I'll go for that.
Okay. I do have a couple of questions, because first of all, I mean, there are, I mean, teaching reading is part of the elementary curriculum now when you're in teacher education, so this is definitely a boost. The one thing about the bill is just to make sure, because you said there were going to be a couple of amendments, because the way it reads, all teachers, and that would be secondary also.
Exactly.
And we secondary teachers don't know how to teach reading because we're hoping that they're all there at the point by the time.
Please.
And so just if that could be made very clear.
Great.
If there are amendments coming. And then, again, just kind of the reality of it would be fantastic if every school could have 3 or 4 reading coaches, but that's not always in the cards. So maybe that's something down the road. When we get to our eight whatever billion, because that is something that's very essential. And in districts that have success with their third grade readers, it takes a lot of instructional assistant time, and they give those resources to that, because it is
and
important.
As you well know, your home district in Tiger Twalin's had some real success with doing this, exactly this type.
And they've been doing it for years.
They
and
have
when
been.
They were, you know, picking up cans on the freeway to pay things, they were doing that. So any other questions?
It's a very tidy area, though.
Yes, very neat. We have no cans on the freeway. Okay, thank you, Representative
Johnson.
Thank you very much. Do we have anyone else to speak on this issue?
Well, Saxton's going to speak on this, right? Because I have another
Apparently
question.
Not.
I've got a question for Rob Saxton.
You have a question for Mr. Saxton?
I do.
We were not going to call you up.
Yeah, well.
She has a question. Why do you look so guilty there?
Is that the question?
Yeah. Representative Springer, do you have a question for the superintendent?
Actually, I do, because I was thinking maybe you were testifying, Rob, and I think you might be able to address this ever so slightly more directly than Representative Johnson. So one of the questions that comes up in my mind as we talk about this, and the language says, and so maybe this is a source of another amendment, the language talks about training applicants to enable applicants to teach students to meet reading proficiencies adopted by the State Board of Education. So that's a very specific mandate. And then the second one is to test students to ensure that the students are meeting reading proficiencies adopted by the State Board of Education. So my question would be, as you look at those two things, would you like to see the bill? I think they just showed you that. When we look at those two things, are we talking about instruction that is so focused that the change from the State Board of Education could impact that? What concerns me is when we put into statute what is taught. That concerns me a little bit. So can you take care of that concern for me, maybe?
Chair Doherty, Representative Springer, members of the committee, for the record, Rob Saxton, Deputy Superintendent of Public Instruction. Actually, I was looking at the bill in the back of the room and thought the use of the word proficiency an interesting one, and tried to think about what it might say that would be better. I thought about perhaps the choice of the word standards, because the State Board does adopt standards, but not necessarily proficiencies. One might also say a proficient reader at the third grade reading level, which actually would be my favorite, because there is a third grade reading level that is not necessarily a standard or a proficiency. It's probably more like a proficiency than it is a standard. And so I'm not trying to use a bunch of gobbledygook, but words that educators sometimes use and I sometimes use as an educator, but it is that we want students to read proficiently by the end of third grade. And so there needs to be a level that we designate as third grade reading level.
Right.
And so I think having that in the bill, third grade reading level as designated by the State Board, would be what we would hope that it would say.
Could I follow up? And you and I have had some conversations about some initiatives that you've worked on in your original or your home district, and certainly some things we're working on the state level. My concern would be, and maybe this is not a valid concern, but my concern would be that the teaching then would be at the university would be so focused that you and I had a very candid conversation about how to teach reading, which I do not know how to do. But in that conversation, you talked about that being something that can be pretty sacred on how you do that. So are we looking at setting up a system at the university level that would be one method, or have such latitude within that method that if you have an administrator in a district saying, we are really drilling down on third grade reading level and we're going to do things this way, so we have some consistency, will those two things run afoul of each other?
Chair Doherty, Representative Springer, really a great question and a hard one to answer. I would say that there are multiple ways to teach reading, and there have been what educators call reading wars for a long time, specifically around direct instruction and whole language, typically are the two methodologies that people talk about, and then a lot of other folks talk about a balanced methodology that's someplace in between. And to Representative Frederick's point, joyous reading is also really important, right? And so my way of thinking about this, and as we thought about the age 3 to grade 3 literacy initiative, which we'll be talking about here very soon, is that the key component here is that educators on a local level get together and talk about how they want to teach reading to students, and that there is a consistency in the delivery of teaching methodology and the way that the teaching is done within a system so that students move through the system in a coherent way, receiving instruction. And that something that's really difficult for a student is if they have a teacher who wants to do whole language, and then the next year they have a teacher who wants to do direct instruction, and the next year they have somebody who wants to do something else entirely. And that as a student moves through the system, if there's no coherence, it's really problematic to learn anything, let alone the decoding skill of reading. And so it would be my hope that it would be that if there were an assessment about how to teach reading, that would be broad enough to encompass a number of different ways to go about that, and that locally educators would get together and determine how they hope to teach it effectively.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of.
Well,
no,
and I would assume
I think that's the clearest answer that we can get to today.
And, you know, it goes without saying you don't dictate what a curriculum is in statute.
No.
So, no. Stay away from that.
So it's just a follow-up to that, Madam Chair. I think it's a great idea as we move through and amendments are discussed. One of them would be that would be important to me is discuss how and if TSPC manages this piece, number one, and number two, that we have language that allows for a school district to make some of those decisions as far as consistency goes within their own programs.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe this language gets us there. I don't know.
Because he's right. You can't do direct instruction, then whole language, and then, you know, those kind of things.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Okay, thank you. Did we have anyone else signed up? That was it. So any other comments on the work session for House Bill 3069? Okay. With that, I close the work session or the public hearing on House Bill 3069. And open up an informational hearing on hubs. Megan.
Thank you. Okay. Chair Doherty, members of the committee, good afternoon. Thank you for having us here today for this informational session on early learning hubs. For the record, my name is Megan Irwin, and I'm the Acting Early Learning Systems Director at the Department of Education. And we are here today to talk about early learning hubs. I'm going to give you an overview that's a little bit more detailed than what we did when we did our whole systems overview at the start of session around what the hubs are and the Early Learning Division and Early Learning Council's recommendations for where they should go next. And to put this presentation in context for you, right now the Senate is contemplating a bill that would move the hubs from demonstration project status to permanent status. And I imagine once that bill winds its way through that chamber, it will come to this committee. And we wanted you to have the chance to understand more about what they are. And in addition to that, wanted you to have the chance to hear from people who are actually leading the work around the state. And so I've brought with me today a group of three hub leaders doing this work in their communities, I'm going to do my best to be brief in laying out the policy, because I think the most meaningful information that you'll hear today will be from the people who are actually doing the hub work on the ground. So just by way of a little bit of context, the early learning hubs were created to make resources and supports more available, more accessible, and more effective for children and families who have historically been overrepresented in the opportunity gap and underrepresented in access to early learning services. The hubs are tasked to work with the state to build a more coherent and cohesive early learning system out of what we know has traditionally been a patchwork of system, a patchwork of programs and services on the ground. And I get asked a lot, what are the hubs actually responsible for doing? This slide distills it down to the most simple level. They have four things that at their core they're responsible for. They're responsible for identifying the population of children in their communities who are at risk of arriving at kindergarten unprepared for formal school, and then working to identify the specific needs of those children and their families. And then most importantly, working across sectors to connect those children and families to services and supports that will meet their needs. And the hubs are actually statutorily required to work across sectors, which is a pretty special part of their work. I think they work with the healthcare sector, with human services, with the K-12 system, though really with elementary schools, so we're really talking K-3, and with the private sector to connect kids and families to services that will meet their needs. And then they're responsible for accounting for outcomes collectively across the system as well. Broadly speaking, the hubs are responsible for working with the state to make sure that the early childhood system is aligned, coordinated, and family-centered, that children are supported to enter school ready to succeed, and that children are raised in healthy, stable, and attached families. So you hear the three goals that are on this slide repeated all the time when we're talking about our early learning work, because every program that we run points toward these three goals. These are the goals of the division and the council. They're also the goals of the early learning hubs. We're really working to align the targets that we're all working toward so that we actually have a cohesive system. In the case of the hubs, they're creating regional strategies for how to support their focused population of kids and families from the time that they're born until they enter school to help us reach these three goals. And you know, one of the reasons that I believe we actually need locally based coordinators for the early learning system is that our system to date really has been such a loose collection of programs and services. Some are public, like the Oregon Pre-Kindergarten Program. Some are private, like childcare in our state is predominantly run out of small businesses that folks run out of their homes. Most of our early learning programs in the state have really specific eligibility requirements. Those eligibility requirements don't line up with each other, so the requirements for one program are different from the requirements for another, and almost all have really long wait lists. And so the problem with that kind of an approach to early learning systems building is that it relies on the people who need services to find their way to those services, and it relies on a program having a slot open when the person does find their way there. And then also, you know, funding is tied up in programs with specific rules and guidelines, which limits the ability to innovate. And to be fair to programs, they're busy conducting their core business, right? If you run a preschool program, you're busy running a preschool program. So they don't always have time to spend a lot of time thinking about how to organize around a solution to serve unserved children and families, just if you're focused on running your program. And that is a problem because there are, we estimate about 25% of our under five population that's exposed to risk factors that do impact their development and their learning and ultimately their readiness for school. And further, thanks to a question that Representative Springer asked in Ways and Means, we estimate or we know that we are only serving about 12% of our under five population in our formal state-funded early learning services right now. And so, of course, the hubs don't solve all of these problems, but they are set up to be the sort of organizing body locally that can take us a long way toward finding solutions, because they have the power to hone in on what the challenges are locally, to do that convening work across programs and sectors, to really engage in that local problem solving, and then push the resources that are available to them toward innovative solutions for solving those problems. And you're going to hear a little bit more concretely from the folks who actually are doing the work on the
ground, what some of that has started to look like. Over the last year, 16 hubs have been locally developed across the state. The oldest one signed its contract with us 11 months ago. You'll hear from its board chair, Sue Miller, in just a little bit. And the youngest one signed its contract with us in February. This map shows you where they're located. And again, no one can tell their stories as well as they can, so I will let you hear from the group on how it's going. One thing that I do like to point out to folks is the entities that you see established here are all run by slightly different kinds of backbone organizations. So we have hubs that are run by nonprofits like the United Way. We have one who founded its own new nonprofit. We have one that's run by a coordinated care organization, a handful who are run by education service districts, and then one that's run by a county. But there's a real diverse mix in terms of who communities selected to actually have run the early learning hubs. Before I hand things over
I assume that the other two areas are in the process of
yes, Chair Doherty, members of the committee, thank you for asking. The two salmon-colored regions on the map are regions that we designated as a region for a hub, but the communities there just needed a little bit of extra time and support to get to a point where we were ready to execute a contract back in July when we made those final decisions. We are pretty close. My staff tell me that within the next month they expect to be bringing the proposals for those two communities forward to the council for consideration.
Okay, thank you.
Yep. So I wanted to just touch on a couple things before I hand it over to my local partners. Funding, then metrics, and then our recommendations for the future. So I know that this is not a funding committee, but as you hear folks talk about the work that they've been doing, I just want you to keep in mind the resources that they've had available. So the resources for the hubs are all funds that we were able to repurpose from the former Commission on Children and Families. In the 2013 session, we were given $4 million to build the hubs. That amounted to $50,000 in startup coordination funding for each hub and $15 per child for the biennium for the hubs to do their operating work. So for our hub, and then we were able to pull in some funding streams, some of that $3 million that went to family support has gone to the hubs. The Great Start funding we were able to pull into the hubs in the second year of the biennium. Still not a ton of resource when compared to the previous commission. For our largest hub, which serves Multnomah County, they've had about $900,000 to operate. Our smallest, most remote, it's less than $200,000, and that's because we made some population adjustments to allow them to have enough operating capital to exist. And so I bring that up just so that you can be as impressed as I am when you hear them talk about the work that they've been doing and just really how wonderful it is that they've been able to get as far as they have with the resources available. I also wanted to take just a second to talk about metrics. We know that hubs need to be accountable to metrics, and we believe really strongly that that accountability needs to be consistent across the state. This is one thing that distinguishes Oregon's approach to community-based early learning system building from other states. Every hub is responsible for the same metrics in their contracts. We developed the metrics that we have by convening a group of hub leaders, partners, and measurement experts over the course of 6 months to develop a set of really clear desired outcomes and then short-term indicators and long-term indicators for success that they'll be held responsible to. What you see here are the principles that guided that metrics creation work. And then you can see here some of the short-term metrics that we've staged out. We staged out short-term and long-term indicators of success because we wanted to recognize the need to measure progress right now and also recognize that making really big changes at the population level for children, we're probably on more of a five-year time horizon. If you think about babies who are being born this year, as they move through the next 5 years of their life and start to enter into kindergarten, the hub system will have existed for about 6 years by then, and that's when we start to expect to see some population-level changes. Here is just more of the metrics that they're responsible for. These are all very process-oriented because this is the piece around system coordination, which is just a lot of collaborative process work. And then finally, I wanted to just touch on the recommendations that the division and the Early Learning Council have developed. We were required to develop these recommendations as part of House Bill 2013 and submit them in a report that we submitted to the legislature in early February. The one that probably most concerns this committee is the first one, the legislature giving the hubs permanent statutory status, and that's what Senate Bill 213 would do. The rest of these recommendations really have to do with the way that the Early Learning Division interacts with the hubs and vice versa, with the exception of two recommendations related to funding. We recommend that the legislature continue to fund core early childhood programs directly, and we also recommend that the legislature adequately fund the hubs so that they can do all of the big things that we're asking them to do. And this just continues the recommendations. They're all in the report as well. So that is really the overview of the policy that I wanted to present to you. And it's really my pleasure for you to have the chance to hear from the people that we've invited to share how this has taken shape over the past year for them. We've invited Sue Miller, Zeke Smith, and to come and talk with you. These folks were all part of the first cohort of hubs that we were able to get under contract, and I'd like to invite them up now, and then I'll come back after they're done if there's any questions that should really come to me. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
You guys come on up.
Why don't we have all the panels, and when we have questions, we'll have questions at the end. Please go ahead.
All right, thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, co-chairs, and committee members. My name is Sue Miller. I am the chair of the Early Learning Hub, Inc., which is serving Marion County currently. Soon we will be serving Marion and Polk County. We're in a unification process right now. I've been in the early childhood field for many years. I was the executive director of the Relief Nursery, serving Marion and Polk counties for 12 years, and just retired from that a few years ago. So I know there are great programs in the early childhood system, including relief nurseries, Head Start, Early Head Start, Migrant Head Start, child care providers, doing really important work, and they have been for years and years. So we're starting from a really strong base. What's happening with the early learning hubs that's new and that's really transformative are the other sectors that are at the table now with the early childhood providers. Now on our board of directors, we have the healthcare sector represented, as well as the education sector with two superintendents of K-12 systems, our largest districts in Marion County, as well as the superintendent of the ESD. So the cross-sector collaboration is happening at the board level and then also at the implementation level below that. From the healthcare field, we have the head of our CCO, the CFO of our major physician organization in the Marion-Polk County area, also the head of our Marion County Public Health Department. So very strong representation in both education and healthcare. The other big change, as I see it, is that the hubs have us very focused, and Megan referred to this a minute ago. We have very, very clear goals that we have to achieve with getting children ready for kindergarten, having stable attached families, and coordinating care. So early learning is now the focal point for all of us. I'd like to just offer one example of what this cross-sector collaboration is turning into in our community. Many of you, I'm sure, are familiar with a screening tool called the Ages and Stages Questionnaire, the ASQ. This is a nationally recognized screening tool that assesses whether a child is on track to meet the developmental milestones that would be expected at any given age, starting at infancy. Parents can administer the ASQ as well as child care providers and many other early learning providers. They do, and they have for years and years. The real key on the ASQ is to make sure that the healthcare providers get the results of that screening, even when it's not performed by them so that they can then provide the referral to the services that might be needed if a child is falling behind in some certain area of development. That has not happened historically. The screens are done, but they have not been getting to the medical care providers. That is now, in our hub, is being developed with the help of the Oregon Health Authority, as well as the medical providers that are at our table, and all of the early childhood providers who are performing these screens. Ultimately, that's going to make a big difference as far as making sure that the children are on track developmentally and that the medical community is able to make sure the referrals happen. So it may sound like a small thing, but you're educators, so I'm sure you know that identifying developmental issues early is absolutely essential to having the children on track by the time they get to kindergarten. Mm-hmm. One example of what's happening on the ground. So I will turn to Zeke for another part.
Thank you. Chair Daugherty, committee members, thank you very much for the opportunity to be here today and speak in front of you about early learning hubs. My name is Zeke Smith. I work at the United Way of the Columbia Willamette in the Portland metropolitan area. And we are in a unique position in that we are actually a co-convener for two different hubs. So we're both a convener for the Early Learning Multnomah Hub in partnership with the Department of County Human Services in Multnomah County. And then we are a co-convener in Washington County with the Department of County Community Services in Washington County. We're in this position because in each community, for different reasons, there are different communities. There were individuals, institutions that requested that we would engage differently, and I will get to in a moment how that was a unique opportunity, I think, in terms of the hub. So we're excited to be in that position. In Multnomah County, our hub came, we received a contract in May of last year. In Washington County, we received a contract in November. So both fairly newer hubs. In each case, much of the work has been built on and really supported by people who had deep experience with commissions on children and families. So we've been intentional about really trying to take the work that had been done in each of those communities and make sure that there's a through line as we think about the work we want to do forward. That being said, I wanted to touch on, similar to what Sue said, a few of the distinctions that have really, I think, helped to frame the work of the hubs in each of those communities. As she talked about, there has been focus that I think we think of in two different ways in both counties that have been really intentional and have made a different made for a different kind of support than we had previously. One of those is a focus on age. So really thinking about 0 through 6 year olds and their families as a population that we're going to look at across multiple sectors. So having the space to bring different parties together, think about that 0 through 6 year old population and the kinds of supports we need to have in place, and then to be intentional about how we align those services has been a distinction for us. And then the other piece in terms of focus is really targeting the population that we're trying to impact the most. So the recognition that there are significant disparities as we talk about supporting 0 through 6 year olds and their families, and that if we're going to be intentional and effective about how we align and coordinate resources, that we've really got to target those resources. And that came from the initial legislation, and it's something that has really been supported in both of those communities. So for us, that really means children in poverty, and it means children of color specifically, because we know that the disparities are so significant in those particular communities. And then lastly, the other distinction that I think has been important, and Sue talked a lot about this, is the broader involvement of the different sectors that we've been able to bring to the table. So having leadership from each of our CCOs in both of those communities at the table, the role for the United Way as a co-convener, this has been a unique experience for us in relation to our county. It creates an opportunity for us to deepen our relationship in those communities, which is important and significant. And it also, I think, allows for us to bring some different voice and perspective to the table, given the relationships that we have, particularly in the business and corporate community. So those have been some distinctions about the early learning hubs that have been important for us. I want to give you two really quick examples, one from each county, of what that work starts to look like on the ground. So in Multnomah County, we have
put in place a set of early literacy kits that are culturally specific kits developed by a set of culturally specific providers in partnership with our county library system. And we are now distributing 4,000 of those kits through those organizations, including the library, to families in those particular communities. What on the surface of that, that's 4,000 new kits that are about how families can really support their young children in the development of early literacy skills in a way that makes sense to them. Great. It's wonderful. As we dig underneath it, I think part of what's really important to articulate there is the process to get to those kits was also a new and different process. So having the culturally specific organizations working with the library, having the library in essence step aside and say, we've got some idea about the basic tools from an evidence perspective, but having the culturally specific organizations in a position to say, and here's what we know about our community. Here's what we know about our communities and how we can use these tools effectively in our community. So while the kind of evidence-based practices look common across those communities, the stories, the songs, and the specific content is different for each one of the different communities. So we have those in Vietnamese, in Spanish, and then we also have them specifically for Native American and African American families as well. In Washington County, there was an existing family resource system, which was supported both by Washington County resources and then Old Commission resources. This was broadly a way for families to engage in local districts to get a sense of what kinds of services were available. With the shift to the Early Learning Hub, we focused those resources on family resource managers. So we've been working in all 7 school districts to create family resource manager positions who work with 0 through 6-year-olds and their families. So it's really a focus on the broader community and kids who are coming into those systems. And then really being intentional about how we align those resources to support those families. So again, you can hear in those examples where the focus has been helpful for us as we think about alignment and coordination. Where the intentionality behind the initial support from the legislature has been important, and where we're really trying to build on past strengths and efforts as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Lastly.
Good afternoon, Chair Doherty and members of the committee. Thank you for having us here today. I am Holly Marr. I'm the Director of Education at United Way of Lane County and with the Lane Early Learning Alliance, which is our local early learning hub. And in Lane County, our hub is working to make sure that early learning services are more available, more accessible, and more effective for children and families who are often underrepresented or underserved in current systems. And similar to my colleagues here from Marion and Multnomah County, we came to contract just under a year ago in May. And have been quite busy since then. We've had many successes in convening partners across sectors, particularly with our partners in our coordinated care organization and the healthcare sector, and with K-12 education. Both having shared metrics with the hub have been instrumental in moving the work forward in Lane County. We've also engaged families at the center of our work and held that really as a focus of our local efforts to improve outcomes for kids and families. And for us, the transition to kindergarten has been a central focus in Lane County and one that's bringing early learning and K-12 education. And as Megan mentioned, really, when I say K-12, I mean K-3 elementary schools together in ways that previously have not occurred in our community. And I would say that one example of that is our recent conclusion of kindergarten transition focus groups that we held in partnership with local school districts and our ESD all across Lane County in metro, rural, urban schools, designed to understand from parents of children who have recently transitioned to kindergarten, what does kindergarten transition mean for families? What resources that are useful, and in retrospect, what resources would have been useful for families as their children transitioned into kindergarten? And so we held 9 across the community, as I mentioned, also included families of children with special needs and Spanish-speaking families to get as broad a perspective as we could. And the schools partnered in that they invited families to the schools. We provided the resources, the meals, the child care, and the set of questions for the groups. And we also worked with Head Start parents, I should mention, whose children will be entering kindergarten, to get their perspective as well throughout this process. And so key themes that we found throughout these groups, some were surprising, some were not so surprising. Parents are most concerned, we found, about their children's social and behavioral readiness for school and what that looks like to put your five-year-old on a school bus for the first time. And if you live in a rural and remote community, that could be a school bus with high school age students as well, and that's pretty daunting for families. We also heard that parents, in addition to being concerned about their children's behavioral and social readiness, are very interested in more information about what academic skills their children should have entering kindergarten and how they really can foster that development early on. And we also heard from families that, in addition to being unsure about exactly what skills their children should have and how they can foster that, what resources exist in communities to support that. And on top of not knowing what resources exist, families often don't know if they're eligible, if they qualify for programs, and how they would even access those programs. And more broadly, we heard that parents are very interested in being actively involved in their children's education, but need a little more support and communication from the community, from schools, to understand what that might look like and how they can do that. And we also heard some very important, I think, kernels from families, particularly those with children with special needs, about how we can, as a community, humanize the kindergarten transition process so that it's not just about data and numbers and their child isn't just a figure, but really a child that's entering kindergarten, and how we can, as a community, support that. And so what we've done is we've compiled this information, we're sharing it with our school districts, and using that as a platform to really springboard our P3 prenatal through third grade efforts in partnership with our local regional achievement collaborative to figure out how the early learning hub, schools, the broader community can partner to figure out how we can really serve families in this critical transition period the best that we can. And so that, I think, is one example of how early learning and K-12 are really coming together in our community in ways that hadn't existed before and represent really powerful opportunities for change as we go forward in this work. So thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today.
Are there any questions for this panel? A few questions? Mm-hmm. Representative Frederick.
Chair Doherty, I'm curious about how you mentioned how you're publicizing things in Lane County. How are we doing that in Multnomah County and Washington County? I want some folks to know about those kits. So where do they go, and how do I get that information to them?
Committee Member Frederick, Chair Doherty, thanks for the question. So we have been communicating a little bit differently in each of the two communities. In Washington County, we have a strong steering committee. We're communicating with that steering committee. We recently had a celebration at the county building. Thank you, Chair Doherty, for attending as well. So we're in the kind of initial stages there to really get information out about what we're doing and how that looks different than what has happened previously. I think we're relying or depending significantly on stakeholders that have been engaged with us in Multnomah County. And the question about the early literacy kits, right now those kits are being distributed by the culturally specific organizations that worked with us on that project. So that's the Latino Network, it's Kairos PDX, it's Sneha Family Center, and ERCO, and then also through the library. We're in the process of figuring out how to spread the kits even further than that. And, you know, to some degree, that's about the actual kits themselves, which we think are really important. But we also think that it's important that as other communities or as other organizations use those kits, that the design process was an important part of what occurred there. So the ability to really shape the content based on what local communities understand and know was important. So we're still working on it. I can get you specific information on the kits themselves, but we're in the first kind of phase of putting those resources out in the community.
Okay, thank you.
Just a quick follow-up.
Quick.
The Portland schools did similar kits not that long ago. You might check and see where that information is, because it was actually available in the late 90s and early 2000s, and they were effective. But I would also encourage you to be looking outside of the organizations. For me, I would get that information to the beauty salons and the barbershops and the pediatricians' offices and some of the faith community, because those are the folks that are actually talking with those kids about those things. So please, I was just a suggestion. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Springer, then Representative McClellan.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe this is for you, Sue, or certainly any of you. I'm trying to look at this as from a practical standpoint, and I think back to a kiddo that my husband and I had in our lives for a few years ago. Dad really struggled. School night, Dad put me on as an emergency contact, so everybody was doing everything above board. And we were trying to bring supports to them because there were lots of issues. And at that time, there was a cute acronym for it. I don't remember what it was, but it was a bunch of state and county government agencies that came together to bring supports to the table. And they were just there for the taking, all sorts of things. And nobody should be forced to do something they don't want to participate in, or participate in something they don't want to. We couldn't get Dad past, I'm from the government and I'm here to help you, kind of thing. Are you running into that? How do you deal with that? Because it sounds like, and maybe I'm not hearing the rest of it, it sounds to some degree like passive engagement. Here's a venue and here's things that you can take. And I remember when our son was born, somebody knocked on the door and said, "Hi, I'm from the government and I'm here to help you." And with a book, and we said, "Thank you, and you know, we're good and appreciate your efforts." What are you doing with that? Do you come up with a lot of resistance there? How are you addressing that, and what's going on there? Or does that resonate at all?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Springer, for the question. As you know, and Megan's slide pointed out, we, the hubs, don't provide services. Mm-hmm. So we won't be showing up at your door
right. Saying
we're the hub and we're from the government. Plus, we're not private nonprofit, yeah. So we're not from the government. Although we appreciate your funding, I better say. We have a parent advisory committee that has been active, for many months now, and we really rely on them to give us advice and direction on how to approach parents. Not that we will, but how our partners can approach parents. What are they looking for? We're just at the end of our process of developing a parenting education website, and we've contracted with a Latina woman who has done a lot of these but also understands and has done focus groups with parents to say what will attract you to look at the website and do more than a 10-second click on the front page. So we're trying to really embrace families and encourage our partners to do that. The other piece, and it's sort of what you're suggesting, that is very targeted with services. Our primary strategy is we have identified the 16 highest need catchment areas in Marion County. And we have put in very specific intensive programs for professional learning communities to connect kindergarten teachers with the early learning and 0 to 3 providers. But we're providing services at those schools for families who have young children, as well as kindergartners or older kids. So we're trying, through leaflets and door knocking and home visiting of our partners, to make sure that families know that these services are available at their neighborhood school. All they have to do is walk down the street and they're accessible. And that, and their, you know, health care as well as kindergarten, as well as early learning and child care providers are a huge part of our network now. They are really getting the word out to their families that there are these services out there that they can access. No needs, you know, you don't have to come in and show your income or whatever. They are in our schools. So that's where all of these, the synergy starts happening with all of these different providers finding different ways to access children. You know, we've got to find the kids who aren't already in Head Start or Relief Nurseries, mm-hmm. as we all know.
Okay, and committee, we've got one more panel to go, and they've got only half an hour. So any other questions, short ones for this?
I was just going to make a comment, if I could, Madam Chair. I just appreciated what Sue just had to say, because I've seen that work firsthand. And the relationship that the hubs are building with the teachers and the providers in the communities is the key. That's what's working, because they're the trusted ones. They're the ones that have the relationships with these families, and that's where the trust comes. And so that's where it's so different and unique than anything else that we have done. So I just appreciate that you brought that up. So thank you for doing that, and I hope all of you are doing that, because that's really where it's at. Mm-hmm.
Britt McLean, do you have a quick question for these?
I'm going to wait.
Pardon?
I'm going to wait.
Okay, fine. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Okay, so next we have... the next panel.
Thank you guys so much. Okay, so.
Sorry, we only have a half an hour for everybody else, so. So I won't ask you 48 questions.
Yeah, Rob and I have got this down. So I'm not sure where the age 3 to grade 3 PowerPoint is. So I don't need it. Rob's the one that has the slides. I'm going to just start, just in the interest of time. So again, Megan Irwin, Acting Early Learning System Director. Chair Doherty, members of the committee, really excited to also get to be here today to talk to you about the age 3 to grade 3 literacy initiative. And I think that some of what you'll hear us talk about really builds on what you heard the hubs talk about, especially some of the things that Holly highlighted and Sue just highlighted around the need to really connect early learning to elementary schools. Given today's time, I'm just going to briefly outline the core components of the early side of the equation with this initiative, and then hand to Rob to talk more about the K-3 instructional components before I think we get to hear from a few other practitioners in the field. So one of the reasons why I think that this work is so important is that in Oregon, we're starting to think about the first 8 years of a child's life comprehensively for the first time. And that's important because learning doesn't just happen on the first day of kindergarten. And we believe that if we're going to reach our goals for school readiness and third grade reading proficiency and ultimately high school graduation and beyond, we really have to focus on creating strong alignment between what happens before kindergarten and what happens after. And there's a growing recognition in light of pretty significant evidence that if we want children to read on grade level by third grade, starting at kindergarten is too late. Rob actually tells a wonderful story about his own coming to Jesus and learning that as a superintendent. We have 8 years from the time that a child's born until they graduate from third grade to focus on vocabulary and language acquisition and self-regulation. And then, of course, as children get older, developing their formal reading skills. And so this initiative really gives us the chance to connect all of those pieces into something that's much more cohesive and experience for young children and their families. And I have to say, this is more than just a good idea that we had. We're actually seeing this work in small pockets around the state through the early learning hubs partnering with their school districts. We've seen as much. You heard some examples of that from the previous panel. And I also just want to point out that across the state right now, we have 9,000 children who just participated in a school transition program where curriculum and professional development had been aligned, where there was a really strong summer before kindergarten program and a really strong handoff at the start of kindergarten. And the children who participated in those programs, we really did see them start kindergarten at a level of readiness that was higher than peers from their same area and also higher than what we see on average around the state. So this is an investment, this is an initiative that builds on the work that we've done over the last biennium to build a cohesive, aligned education system that's pointed toward what really is best for young learners. And on the early side of the equation, it does four things that are important. It connects standards in a way that is developmentally appropriate for early literacy and language development that happens in our early childhood programs to what happens once children start kindergarten, first, second, and third grade. It provides children the opportunity to participate in kindergarten transition programs the summer before kindergarten, which, again, we've seen just really works. There's tons of data I could put in front of you to show you that. It puts the power around this work in the hands of communities. It builds on the investments that we've made in that community-based coordinating infrastructure through the hubs and through community-based organizations across the state. And then it facilitates a really just wonderfully warm handoff between early learning programs
programs and the start of kindergarten, which is so important for families. As you heard from Holly, that's the kind of stuff that they have a lot of anxiety about in that summer before school starts. So that's the early side of things. And I'm going to hand it over to Rob to walk you through the other components of the initiative.
Thanks, Megan. Chair Doherty, members of the committee, for the record, Rob Saxon, Deputy Superintendent of Public Instruction. I'm here today in support of Senate Bill 214, and it is the version with the amendments that's posted to OLIS currently. So there are amendments to the bill. So I sit here in front of you today feeling a huge sense of actual urgency and responsibility. We have roughly 15,000 third graders every year in the state of Oregon who don't read at grade level. And we live in what we call the information age. And in the information age, when you can access information, you have an opportunity to be successful. And we access information through reading. And when you cannot read in the information age, you pretty much are doomed. You're doomed to a life of not being able to be successful, to provide for yourself or to provide for your family, or be a productive member of society. And we have 15,000 third graders a year that sit in that place and face that future. So we've been working on this age 3 to grade 3 literacy initiative. I think it is the most exciting thing that I've ever worked on as an educator in my 32-year career as an educator, and it has five really important key components. Megan talked about a little some of those, but at the risk of repeating ourselves, they are, number one, strengthening early learning programs while creating a great handoff between early learning and K-12. Supporting shared professional development, which includes K-12 and early learning educators with standards, methodology for teaching literacy and self-regulation, and the staff development to support those. Full-day kindergarten, and a really robust full-day kindergarten, and it's important for people to hear me say that learning in kindergarten should be joyous learning, and there are all kinds of ways to go about that and have a full, rich day of kindergarten. And if you'll go to a full-day kindergarten classroom with me and see students singing about letters and sounds and dancing and having plays about how to do this learning in a really highly effective and engaging way, then I'd be happy to take you along. Number four, that there would be summer school an after-school program in partnership with community-based organizations, the hubs and school districts. And number five, highly effective literacy programs where we have excellent teaching strategies and evidence-based interventions that are agreed to by educators and hubs within a region so that we have a common system of methodology, which I referred to earlier when Representative Springer asked me questions. And I received a text from one audience member who said, Rob, you should have talked about vocabulary comprehension, phonemic awareness, phonics, and fluency, because we can all agree to that, whether we're whole language or direct instruction, and they are correct. So 66.4% right now of our third graders read at grade level. And when you break this out across demographics, you'll see that some of our subpopulations do much, much worse. So American Indian, Alaska Native at 54.7% of students at grade level. Black students, 49.8%, and Hispanic, 45.5%. And those are things that we cannot allow. And in fact, as we talk about these strategies, we need to make sure that as we're doing the work that we are being culturally relevant, culturally significant, and that the training that we do allows for closing of achievement gaps. As we designed this, we decided not to go small, but to go big. And the question was, how do you put together a literacy program that will ensure that 90 to 95% of all third graders are reading at grade level at the end of 5 years? And we choose 5 years because it takes some time to get there. But as our students who are in preschool today move through this progression and this program, by the time they're third graders, we believe we can get to 95% reading at grade level, which is vastly different than the numbers that I just talked about. It changes their lives, and it really changes who the state of Oregon becomes over time, because we have people who can read and can access information. So students who are reading at grade level by the end of third grade are four times more likely to graduate from high school. And the rest of the data on this slide, especially the bottom part, really is in response to some people saying to me, well, Rob, what would happen if we decided to scale this? Instead of an $85 million request, why don't we talk about what $50 million would do, or $30 million would do, or $10 million would do? And this is a different kind of strategic initiative than we proposed out of the 13-15 session. In 13-15, you found that there were many smaller initiatives that districts or other providers needed to write grants for, and then we had small implementation, and they impacted small groups of students. That's not what this is. This is a statewide every single student age 3 to grade 3 receiving a different kind of instruction and program around literacy to ensure that we get to 90 to 95% reading at grade level. You cannot do that. You cannot get to 90 to 95% without the full implementation of this program. Right now at the Department of Education, we're supporting what we call focus and priority schools. This is just by way of example. And in those focus and priority schools, we have 80 elementary schools where the percentage of students who are reading at grade level approximates about 50% of the students who attend. We've had really good success in helping those schools turn around and get better outcomes with students. But if we were incredibly successful and we got to a place where 90% of all students at those 80 elementary schools read at grade level, the state would move from 66% of students reading at grade level at third grade to 69%. Because there are 667 elementary schools in the state of Oregon, and with the effort that I just described, we are touching only 80. So we can move the dial by 3% if that's where we want to be, or for an $85 million investment, we can move from 66 to 95. And it absolutely is a life changer for every kid who comes through the program and is able to achieve those kinds of results. I talked a little bit about cultural relevancy, and one of the things that I hope to show here is that when we do nothing, basically what we have are students based on these demographic breakouts, and we're going to stay at roughly 66% of our students reading at grade level as we move into the future. If we make really high quality implementation, we'll get this, which is that every single sub-demographic will begin to achieve at a higher level, and more students within that sub-demographic will read at grade level. And but what it really takes is that plus specific attention to cultural relevancy, culturally relevant teaching practices, and engagement of hubs and CBOs who bring parents and communities to the conversation in a different way and actually help us close achievement gaps. And there are districts who have done this work. I can talk about some of those, and I can be happy to give you examples and come back in front of the entire committee and break this down into much more specifics about how this rolls out, or to meet with each one of you individually to talk about that should you have questions. And with that, I would like to wrap up. I'd be happy to answer questions, but also have some people who have traveled a distance to speak to this
okay,
today.
Okay, why don't we have those people come up, and then we'll finish it off with questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Doherty. I'd like to start, please, with Carmen Rubio and Jessica Swindle, please.
And actually, I will bring for the committee on Wednesday a letter from a kindergartner at Templeton Elementary School. And you'll see how they're not really good at spelling at kindergarten, but you can tell that they're sounding out the words.
Good afternoon, Chair Doherty and members of the Education Committee. My name is Carmen Rubio, and I'm the Executive Director of Latino Network, and we're located in Multnomah County. We are a Latino youth and family-serving organization that provides programs in early childhood. Sorry about that. In early childhood, academic supports, and parent and family engagement. I'm here to express my support for the Age 3 to Grade 3 Literacy Initiative because it aligns families, communities, and schools together for children's reading success. For more than a year, I, along with my staff and our families that we work with, educators and districts, have been investing our time, expertise, and community voice into the development of this crucial initiative. We support this collaboration because it includes the development of strong partnerships among districts and community-based organizations and early learning hubs around the state. This initiative will have tremendous impacts on hard-to-reach populations, in part because of its valuing of parents and community-based organizations as critical education partners of schools and teachers. We know this because we've experienced it in our organization firsthand. Young Latinos as a segment of the population is growing faster than any other. And in the next 10 years, Latinos will be a significant part of the economic base in Oregon. Yet this growth far outpaces our educational institutions' ability to be appropriately responsive. Particularly vulnerable are low-income and immigrant parents and students at risk of school disengagement. And these are the youth with low grades, high absenteeism, or disciplinary action, and have failed a class, maybe experienced housing instability, or have changed schools frequently. These are all indicators of success in school. This is why the 3-to-3 initiative is a timely and important step toward building a new education model for today's student, not just for Latino youth, but all children in Oregon. Our current models are leaving too many students behind, and these are the students whose families are currently being served by organizations like ours. Most district demographics across the state are quickly changing, and this is why we need newer, effective ways to close the literacy gap, ways that place equal value on the learning that happens in school, in the home, and also in supportive community organizations. Parents and families are an asset to schools. Study after study states that parent involvement and self-confidence are critical factors in a youth's educational success, and speaking Spanish in the home is a plus. Bilingualism has been linked to stronger cognitive abilities and is also a competitive and sought-after school skill globally today. When parents are equipped to become successful teachers and leaders within their own families, we are impacting generations of future Oregonians. The good news is that partnerships like the 3-to-3 initiative calls for are working right now. Some individual districts are already partnering with culturally specific providers to bridge the cultural impasses that may exist in their districts and create capacity within the school to fully engage communities of color. One of these examples is our partnership with Portland Public, with Reynolds, and Park Rose School District to provide our program called Juntos Aprendemos, and in English that means Together We Learn. This program engages parents early, before their children enter school. Juntos Aprendemos brings Latino children ages 3 to 5 and their parents and caregivers into the neighborhood school for 30 weeks to develop the early literacy, early math, and social-emotional skills necessary for success in kindergarten. Meanwhile, their parents learn skills to support their children's early learning at home, participate in their children's develop healthy parent-child communication practices, and promote their children's positive cultural identity. Our children leave Juntos ready to learn in kindergarten with literacy readiness skills at 95% and above. Parents exit armed with knowledge about how to support literacy development in the home and in the school. Culturally specific programs make a difference. Parents report on its positive effects on their children's confidence, attendance, and enthusiasm for education. Parents are hungry for opportunities to connect with schools, teachers, and school leadership in a manner that values their engagement, their history, and their language. So much, in fact, that we all often have waiting lists for our school-based literacy programs. One father, Genaro, determined to access literacy support for his daughter, Itzel, came faithfully week after week to our Juntos Aprendemos program at Glenfair School in East Portland after being told that the program was full. He would arrive every week with his daughter dressed up with her hair in braids, holding her hand as they waited together outside in the portable classroom in the rain, hoping a spot would open up in our program. We were eventually able, after about 4 weeks, to accommodate Genaro and Itzel in our program, and now they are among our most active families. School-community partnerships are a formula that works. Our outcomes prove that in our case. The Age 3 to Grade 3 initiative gives all Oregon communities the same opportunity to narrow the literacy gap and invest in the unlimited potential of every child. So on behalf of the many families and children that we work with, I urge you to please support this important initiative moving forward. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Doherty and committee members. Thank you so much for your time here today. For the record, my name is Jessica Swindle, and I'm a literacy specialist at Metzger Elementary and Tiger Tualatin School District.
Very good school, by the way.
Yeah. I've also been a second grade teacher and a third grade teacher, and prior to that, I was a home visitor for Early Head Start, bringing literacy resources to migrant families in the Portland area. As a literacy specialist, my entire job consists of teaching students to be proficient readers, providing interventions where students need them, and coaching and supporting our teachers as they implement effective, evidence-based practices in literacy instruction. This is the first time that I've ever come here to provide testimony in support of a bill, but from the moment that I learned about the details of the Age 3 to Grade 3 Literacy Initiative, I knew that this was so valuable and critical for our students right now that I had to come and speak up for myself and also for the teachers and literacy specialists on the ground in Oregon doing this work right now. Teachers at Metzger and around the district are in agreement that this is one of the most exciting pieces of legislation that we have seen for our kids in a long time. As we know, the achievement gap is well entrenched long before our students reach the doors of a kindergarten classroom. I see firsthand each fall how 70 to 80% of our students living in poverty come to school not knowing any letter sounds or letter names. Many of them are actually opening a book and turning the pages for the first time in a kindergarten classroom, and that's not an exaggeration. We know that their more affluent peers have had a minimum of 5 additional years in a literacy-rich or a language-rich environment. We also know that by the age of 4, those same children have experienced 30 million more words than their peers who are living in poverty. And that's words that have been sung to them, read to them, spoken to them. At Metzger, as you said, we intervene quickly, and we provide 90-plus minutes of rigorous but joyful literacy instruction every single day for our kiddos. And many of them, most of them, meet benchmark by the spring of kinder. However, despite the fact that they do meet benchmark by kinder, what we see is that some will lose almost as much as they've gained over the summer. And then, as we progress through first grade, second grade, and third grade, our overall proficiency rates for our students in poverty and students of color continue to decline. We know that this trend continues into middle school and high school. The Age 3 to Grade 3 Literacy Initiative will increase access to high-quality early childhood education. It will ensure collaboration and shared professional development for our early childhood providers and K through 3 teachers. This would also include our in-home child care providers who have never really been included at the table. And this is huge because these are where our kids in poverty are spending most of their time before kinder. So it's not just about creating new resources and support for kids. This is about improving the literacy instruction across the board in the facilities and the settings that already exist, where our kids already are. Head Start and Early Head Start are wonderful programs, but they are also only able to serve a fraction of our students. Our state needs a widespread and an intentional plan to systematically improve the early childhood experience and literacy instruction for all students across Oregon. And we believe that the Age 3 to Grade 3 initiative is just that. Senate Bill 214 will increase access and opportunity for summer and extended day learning, as you've heard. These are for the programs for the students who need it most. And what we're talking about here and why I think teachers are so excited is this is the first time that we've seen a real plan that could ensure that students are not only ready when they come to kinder, but also able to retain what they've learned over the summer. If you talk to any kinder, first grade, second grade, or third grade teacher across the state, they will tell you that these are the two main obstacles in closing the achievement gap: getting our kiddos ready before they come and maintaining that over the summer. As Megan mentioned, we know that this will work because there are pockets around the state this type of support has already been provided, and we're already seeing that success. We've seen that kiddos living in poverty who've received 2 years of Head Start, strong family engagement and parent education, access to summer school, all of those supports, they are successful, and they far exceed their peers in poverty without those supports. These isolated cases where those children are successful are definitely celebrations, but if we really want to move the dial and go from 66% to 95% of our third graders reading proficiently, we definitely need a more widespread, multi-tiered, and systematic approach. And that's why the initiative is so exciting for us. I urge you to join teachers and literacy specialists like myself in supporting this really important bill.
Okay, thank you. Do we have other people
coming?
We do,
if it please the committee. We have 3 other people who, and I know that we have about 10 minutes, looks like. I'd like to very much thank Jessica and Carmen for being here today.
Because I'll tell you what they do. If you guys have questions that you need answered, we will get them to Superintendent Saxon. He'll get the answers for us.
But we still have a minute or two to say something at the end of the meeting. We'll make it. Yeah. Right?
Okay.
So if I could, Dana Heppner, Lisa Harnish, and Cleanne Brewer, please.
Okay.
I'll get out of the way.
Okay. Thank you. And we do have your written testimony if you just want to summarize what you guys have. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Doherty, members of the committee. My name is Dana Hepper. I'm the Director of Policy and Program at the Children's Institute. We focus on policy and practice for kiddos birth to 8 years old. And we're here in support of the Age 3 to Grade 3 Literacy Initiative as well. There's obviously mounting evidence connecting third grade reading to high school graduation and later success. That chart that Superintendent Saxton showed that indicated where the different subpopulations are on third grade reading looks strikingly similar to where those exact same groups are at high school graduation. And there's even more mounting evidence that if we get to kids early, even before they get to kindergarten, those investments have the most bang for the buck. Long-term return on investment is the, you know, technical term. So the evidence would point us doing strong supports for kids and families birth to three, getting those kids into high-quality preschool. And I want to be clear, this initiative does have a really strong component of connecting to those in-home child care providers, meeting kids where they are and working to build those skills up. But what this $85 million doesn't include, it's a separate budget item, is getting more kids into high-quality preschool. And so we're advocating for a $30 million investment there. There are 32,000 low-income 3- and 4-year-olds in the state that don't have access to high-quality preschool right now. That's about 3 out of 4 of those kids that don't have access. So we have a huge unmet need that needs to tackle there. That's a perfect complement to what is included in the legislation and budget item here, which is, okay, get them high-quality preschool. That's the other $30 million that we'll talk to you about soon. Get them transitioned effectively, and then once they're in K-3, make sure that those early gains are maintained through those early grades with high-quality instruction and interventions in the summer and wraparound out-of-school time. And I think I'll end there. Thanks.
Thank you.
All right, so good afternoon, Chair Doherty and members of the committee. It's my distinct pleasure to be here with you today in full support of the H3 to Grade 3 initiative. For the record, my name is Lisa Harnish, and I'm the Executive Director of the Early Learning Hub here in Marion County. As we've already heard here today, the Early Learning Hub is heavily invested in working with communities to build a strong foundation for kindergarten. We're so fortunate to have in our community many partners who are working with us. And as a hub, we're able to better coordinate the great work that is happening across the disciplines, such as education, early learning, social services, families, the business community, health, and like. We are aligning our strategies to better meet the needs of kids and families ages 0 to 6. And we know here in Marion County that our children are not arriving at the kindergarten doors ready to be as ready for kindergarten as they could be. We know in particular their ability to know the letter names and the letter sounds are well below the state average and even the county average. We also know, as we've heard very eloquently today, that third grade reading is one of the biggest predictors for graduation and success in life beyond, and to ensure that kids are ready to be able to read in third grade, a strong foundation prior to kindergarten is vital. A few examples that are happening here in Marion County that align with the work with H3 to grade 3 include some of the work that are happening within our 16 area neighborhood areas that we're working with our school partners and early learning partners and child care partners to align and professional development and professional learning communities to help ensure that kids are ready for kindergarten. We are also, as a part of that, doing a lot of work to engage families in those neighborhood areas and connecting them early into the school system so that they can help their children at home be better ready for kindergarten. In many communities, such as in Staten and Mary Lynn, we're working directly with child care providers to help connect them in with the work of ensuring that kids are ready for kindergarten by helping support them with curriculum and books and other literacy-rich environment things that they can do in their child care, whether it be center-based or home-based, to help kids be more ready for kindergarten. Also, with parent education and parent training, such as Abriendo Puertas, opening doors, or making parenting a pleasure, we're including child care as a part of that, but we're really focusing in helping the instructional aides or child care providers to provide kindergarten readiness activities and literacy-rich activities. In addition, we're working with our healthcare providers here in our communities to participate in Reach Out and Read, which at well child checkups from ages 6 months through 5 years, the doctors are giving children and their families an age-appropriate book and also discussing the importance of reading and the joy of reading and helping to provide literacy in the homes. We're also including on a broader scale our child care partners in assisting them in become a part of the quality rating and improvement system and working with them to ensure that they've got literacy as a strong component within the child care community. As has been mentioned all afternoon, it's connecting the web where the children are and helping to ensure that we're bringing forward the importance of literacy all throughout. Is so incredibly important. These are just a few things that are happening right here in Marion County that are in direct alignment with age 3 to grade 3, and what we know is we need to be able to do more, to be able to scale up and scale out our connections with children and families. Thank you so much for the opportunity to be here today.
Okay. Got about five minutes. Got it. We have to vacate for the next committee, so that's why we get shortchanged by 15 minutes in this committee. Go ahead. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Doherty and committee. My name is Cleanne Brewer, and I'm a student achievement specialist in the David Douglas School District. I'm formerly a special education teacher in the Tiger Tualatin School District, and I'm here today to talk about the importance of the age 3 to grade 3 initiative. In all of my work as a special education teacher and a student achievement specialist, I have been able to help develop comprehensive literacy programs for children at all levels in Tiger Tualatin and David Douglas. We have in David Douglas implemented a full-day kindergarten program for all students, and we are noticing that our literacy data across the board since we've started a full-day kindergarten program has impacted children greatly. We have started to implement multi-tiered support systems, so we look at reading achievement data as soon as children walk in the door, and we provide reading intervention programs for those struggling students or students who are at some risk of struggle. In addition, we collaborate with teachers weekly to make sure that we're talking about all students across a grade level and make sure that they're reading at appropriate levels and enjoying reading, not only learning how to read, but reading to learn as well. We also have started to develop parent education classes in multiple languages, and in fact, translate some of our professional learning for parents into English instead of other languages, so that we can really celebrate the diversity within David Douglas, and bring multiple perspectives to the table. We are also working on extended day programs, working through Sun schools in all elementary schools, so that we can connect our research-based instruction to before and after school programs for those struggling students and students at high risk. In addition, we are we are also providing early kindergarten transition programs for all elementary schools so that we can build those connections mm-hmm. before school starts and get them ready for kindergarten, get families ready, get teachers ready, so that we are tying both systems together so everybody has success. I am in full support of age 3 to grade 3 initiative. Thank you for your time.
Great. We do have a minute or two for questions. Pressing questions we have. Thank you very much, all of you, for coming. Very, very important. I observe the hubs out in Washington County and the cooperation between the family resource centers, the school districts, the libraries, the daycare providers is amazing. Mm-hmm. And I'm very optimistic about the results that you're going to get.
Brief. Huh? So just one thing that really hasn't come up as loudly as I'd like to hear it, in addition to the idea that we really do like kids to read, but it adds to the stability of the school, mm-hmm. which ripples out into the community. And I think there's a benefit of that that you cannot possibly measure. Mm-hmm. But from what I've observed at Dave Douglas, it's building a stronger community mm-hmm. in a very impoverished area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's awesome. So thank mm-hmm. you for all your work.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you much
Thank
for
you.
Your time. Okay, with this, I will close the the informational hearing on early learning hubs and adjourn the meeting. Informational hearing on early learning hubs.